This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information, and that's really important to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth. It's also an important program as well for every people, because we all have a common problem. Every people has a concern about their heritage, about their what we call independence. In fact, America was founded on that principle, that every people have a right to be independent, that they have a right to have a nation reflecting their own values, culture, traditions, heritage, and truly basic interests. Every people basically, without having to say so, everybody has the right to survive. Everyone has the right to live, or at least should have the right to live, to continue on in their existence as a people, as a culture, as a heritage. This is fundamental. In fact, these principles are accepted by most nations of the world, most people of the world. Even in the controlled media today, these principles are accepted. They're accepted for all other peoples, except, of course, for Europeans. Somehow, when Europeans talk about preserving their heritage or their rights, their traditions, their values, even their very genetic identity, they are condemned. And interestingly enough, the same people doing the condemnation are the same people, the same ideology, the same extremist ideology that supports the world's ultimate supremacism, the world's ultimate racism, and that's called Jewish supremacism or Jewish extremism, and some people may call it Judaism, because at its core, Judaism is a racial religion. Now, in some countries of the world, because of Jewish pressure, you can be prosecuted for saying such, but certainly it's obvious. You don't have to do much reading in the Torah or the Talmud, for that matter, which is the true core of Judaism today, to see this racist principle at work, to see the reality of racial survival at work. The idea, for instance, that you're chosen by God among all other people by the virtue of your birth, not by the virtue of your belief, which is the foundation of most religions around the world. In Islam, everyone is a brother, regardless of their heritage, if, in fact, they embrace the Quran and they embrace the writings and the beliefs of Prophet Muhammad and their view toward God, Allah, their view toward the world. They all become brothers. Every Christian around the world considers themselves as brothers with other Christians. In other words, you don't have to have a particular ethnic background to become a Christian. The basic aspect of Christianity is your belief in Christianity. With Judaism, we have a very, very different kind of philosophy. Yes, it's true that some people can say that many Jews don't practice Judaism, and yet, interestingly enough, they're still considered by most members of the Jewish establishment to be, in fact, Jews. Judaism itself is a religion that is extremely ethnocentric. It's extremely concerned about preserving the Jewish genotype. Now, that may sound radical to lots of people, but you can read the writings in the Old Testament, and you can read many of the writings in the Talmud, and you can find that what I'm talking about is absolutely correct. In fact, within Judaism, it's more important for an individual to be of Jewish descent than what his particular viewpoints are on God at one moment or another. There have been many rabbis who have disputed God, questioned God, even questioned the existence of God. Yet they are not expelled from the Judaistic religion, and they're not expelled from that faith. In fact, the Jewish priest class, which is the highest element of Judaism, it's the traditional people, the Kohanim, the traditional people who are supposed to be guardians of the faith, they are restricted into by whom they can, in fact, marry. No Kohanim is permitted to marry even a fellow Jew of religious belief who has a single drop of Gentile blood. That's correct. And we're going to go into this subject some tonight. It's a very interesting subject. In fact, Israel, it's illegal for a Kohanim, which is the kind of the SS of the Jewish state. It's illegal for the Kohanim to, in fact, marry a member of the Jewish religion who, in fact, is not a person of pure Jewish descent. That's illegal by Israeli law. That's correct. I mean, what I'm saying may sound fantastic to a lot of people listening. But we're going to go into that. The main thing I'm happy about is that I'm back with you, broadcasting again. We've had a hiatus here of about a week, and it's not been by choice by any means. One person said to me the other day, wrote me a letter and said, get your finger out of it, you know. You better get busy and start working again. Well, I've been working on many things while we've been away. I've even been able to do some writing on my next book, if I can ever get it completed. It's really my opus. I think it's going to be more important than Jewish supremacism and my awakening, because it really is about where our cause is going and how I think that we can affect victory for our people, for our people's heritage and for their freedom and for truly our destiny, not only in terms of this planet, but our destiny in terms of the universe. I think that our people have a great calling. I think our people have a destiny that goes far beyond even the planet Earth. There are vistas of creation and potential that are just mind-boggling, and I think that we're really at the doorstep of a complete revolution of thought and action and even existence. For the first time in our long history, we have the chance to consciously affect our very essence itself, our DNA, our abilities, our talents. And I really believe very strongly that the way to find an improvement in mankind is not only in terms of our internal character, which all of us must work on at every moment, but I really believe it's the way to you improve ultimately mankind, and you improve our own people. And every people has this responsibility upon themselves, is to improve the very essence of our people themselves. And I think that's all possible, and it's nothing that's terrible. It's the same way that we would want a person to not be sick, and we treat a sickness, the same way that we try to prevent Down syndrome in unborn children, and we can do so in many cases today, the same way we can do gene therapy in these issues. It's the same principle. By the same principle, we can really have people that are of a higher level. And also, it basically talks about restructuring society to make sure that the society encourages the best of our people, encourages the most productive, encourages the people who are very intelligent, encourages the people who are live an honest and a sincere and a decent life. In a lot of ways, the society doesn't. We kind of reward reproductive benefits, for instance, welfare benefits, to, generally speaking, the people who are least qualified, you might say, to conceive. The people who are not responsible with their finances, people who are not responsible with their lives, people not responsible with their sexual contact or conduct, who are not responsible with their abilities are often suspect. These individuals, generally speaking, have the highest number of children in our society. In fact, that's true of almost every society on Earth today. Whereas the very smartest of our people, the most capable, those individuals who have been extremely successful in business or in the arts or in the sciences or whatever aspect of life, education, whatever aspect of life, they tend to have fewer children. The hard-working middle-class taxpayer, he is taxed to the hilt. He can barely make it. In fact, it's even harder on him in many cases than some people at the highest level, because after some point you pay a lot of taxes, but you can still have children and you can afford them. But that middle class, that hard-working American trying to, but who's very diligent, who works very arduously every day, doesn't miss work, is creative and progressive in his attitudes. He pays his taxes. He lives a decent life. He's not committing crimes. He often cannot afford another child. He can't afford another child because of the tax structure. And it's the same tax structure that literally makes this individual support those who shouldn't be having kids in the first place. One thing I did when I was in the legislature at Louisiana State was I worked very hard for bills that simply said that welfare recipients, while the people are receiving welfare, they should at least, as a beginning, as a first structure, sign an agreement, a legal agreement, that they will not conceive children, that they will do whatever they have to do, whether it be abstinence or birth control or whatever, that they will not conceive children while their existence is being paid for by the hard-working middle class of America. Simple as that. Now, some people say that's not fair to the children because they could be cut off of welfare if they do violate this agreement. But the truth is, the children who are being born into these terrible poverty situations, and welfare, in fact, doesn't even solve those problems. Welfare does not really make that life that much better for those kids. In fact, look at the ghettos, the crime, the violence, the destruction of our societies that stem from these areas of many of our major cities and other areas around the world. This is not even just an American problem. It's a problem that exists in Europe and elsewhere around the country, around the world, I should say. And it happens in almost every civilized society. So here they are. They see this benefit of a higher welfare check and more food stamps, even though the child frequently costs more than those benefits. But it's that bigger check is a tremendous incentive for them to have more children. And you see that. And often these welfare recipients don't even know who the father of the child is. And that's a painful situation. You have a whole generation growing up without even knowing who their father is, or having the presence of a loving, concerned, capable father. So we need to kind of change our attitudes and our values, and we have the opportunity with so many different scientific breakthroughs to have people that are truly on a higher level. And we should encourage the best of our people. We should encourage the smartest of our people, for instance, to reproduce together. And you don't do that by any sort of planned mating system or anything like that. You do that by making sure that the smartest kids go to the best universities, not on the basis of how much money their family has, but on the basis of their abilities. And then boys and girls who are of similar and high abilities, they will get together. And then you have a society that encourages them and tries to take away the obstacles for intelligent, productive people to have children. At the same time, it encourages those on welfare to be responsible. In fact, how does a welfare recipient really get control over their own lives until they stop getting on the baby train? Because the baby train, in fact, many times prevents them from, and I know that many people have done a great job with an unwanted pregnancy and taking care of themselves. And again, there are those that show themselves responsible. And I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about those who will do that and still depend upon the largesse of the hardworking taxpayer. During my campaigns, I had many couples come to me and said, you know, we'd love to have another baby, but we can't because we can't afford them. We can't afford to have another child. And the reason why we can't is because we're being forced to finance those people who are not responsible, who are not doing what they need to do to take care of their own lives, to be responsible and hold a job, to do what they've got to do, and who are not responsible also with their sex lives. This is an old story, and it's repeated many times. We've been on about a week, and again, we apologize for that, and it's really kind of a strange situation. We had our provider, which is a major provider, there have been rumors that they're going bankrupt. I don't know whether that's true or not. We've seen no evidence to that effect whatsoever, but their routers, their main ability and their backbone connectivity to the internet was compromised a number of times. In fact, it was a very difficult and long period. And I wouldn't even put it past, you know, some of our our very ardent enemies to have made an effort to try to keep this program and keep our website off the air. It's very damaging to a website when it's down, even for a short period of time, because a lot of people are fickle. They go to a site a few times. If they can't get access to the site, a lot of people just kind of give up, and they just start pursuing something else. We are certainly working very, very hard to build our movement in Europe and America, and I have been working over the last few weeks. I've met with about 150 different individuals throughout Central and Southern Europe, and we've shared many notes. I've helped hopefully educate them on the problem of Jewish supremacism and also the political processes and lessons that I've learned in Louisiana and elsewhere around the world, and I think it's been a very productive time. It seems I can be less and less open about some of that work, but I'm certainly doing my best to take care of it. Let me take a couple of news items, and then we're going to go ahead and continue with the show for a few minutes. Again, you can contact me directly at info44@davidduke.com. That's info44@davidduke.com. And you can go to stormfront.org, the town hall section. Of course, my program initiated that. We're going to have some more programs on town hall as well. I want to also quote to you from an article that's one of the lead stories on davidduke.com, and it's a very revealing article, and it's an article that shows some of the nature of Israel, the side of Israel that a lot of people don't see. A recent article reports that, quote, that Santa Claus, that's right, Santa Claus, was beaten up in Israel. And I don't know if this is the same Santa Claus that graced so many of our homes this past Christmas, but it was certainly one of many Santa Clauses that are out there in the world supporting the idea of giving and the love represented by Christmas. Quote, he's Jewish in every way, but on New Year's Eve, Alexei Shtukin, 42, dressed up as Santa Claus just for fun and paid for his decision dearly. He was set upon by a gang of youths at the Dome nightclub in Tel Aviv and beaten in front of his family. Youths were shouting, dead Christian. This is a translation from Hebrew. It's probably die Christian or, you know, dead Christian. Alexei and his wife had decided to head to the Dome nightclub in South Tel Aviv in order to pick up their daughter, Dasha, 14, who was celebrating the New Year. Went inside to look for it, and someone yelled, Santa Claus. Alexei was convinced that the shout was one of enthusiasm, but was proved bitterly wrong. The youth kept coming after me and kicked me. I shouted to my wife and daughter, get in the car fast. Dasha began to be hysterical. Leave us alone, she shouted, but the youth gathered around the frightened family members, kicking Alexei and yelling, dead Christian. The original article may have been written in Hebrew, which may explain why it says Santa Claus instead of Santa Claus, C-L-A-U-S-E, instead of Santa Claus, C-L-A-U-S. Also, it seems likely the Israeli youth were yelling, die Christian, instead of dead Christian, unless they were making a negative remark about Jesus Christ. This incident is absolutely inexcusable. The victim could have easily been a Christian pilgrim visiting the Holy Land. The United States is giving Israel at least $3 billion a year in financial aid, not to mention military aid and the occasional multi-billion dollar loan guarantees, which are thinly veiled handouts. Now, if this seems like an isolated incident, the Israelis killed an American peace protester, Rachel Corey, and shot a British peace protester in the head who died months later. The Israeli military killed 34 Americans on board the U.S. Liberty in 67 in a deliberate attack to sink that ship. 5 out of 6 radio frequencies used by Liberty were jammed during the attack. In the 1950s, in the Levant affair, the Israelis bombed American facilities in Egypt, hoping to blame the incidents on Arabs to really get American to war with Egypt. Would we give billions of dollars to Somalia where Americans risk being attacked on site? Of course not. So why should we give this kind of aid to Israel? Now, these attacks, you know, on Santa Claus, because Santa Claus is more traditionally of a Christian-type symbol, is is a small example of the incredible anti-Christian animus that exists in Israel. As my website, davidduke.com, shows repeatedly, we've had many cases. In fact, over the last few months and years, there have literally been hundreds of cases where Christian clerics, Christian priests, have been, as Life O'Brien would say, spat at in the face, where Jewish yeshiva students will attack and spit at these Christian clergy, including Greek Orthodox, Protestants, and Catholics, in the face. A pretty disgusting habit, but this has been reported in many media around the world, including the Jerusalem Post, including the Telegraph in Great Britain, and many other papers, and it's still going on, and every few months another incident crops up, and there's many of these incidents that are not reported. Now, other aspects of anti-Christian animus, well, the Israeli government literally financed this and supported the burning of the New Testament in an Israeli square. That's right, a Jewish organization that the government supports burned the New Testament. And you have laws in Israel where if a Christian tries to convert other people to the Christian faith, they can well be sentenced to 5 years in prison in Israel. Pretty interesting, isn't it? This is a post from a gentleman named Ulysses. He says, Emergence of Menace. It infuriates the Jewish community that the greatest writer in all of history wrote a brilliant play that depicts Jews as well as Jews. Recently here in Canada, a local university staged production of The Merchant of Venice, the university being under an extreme leftist administration that not only stresses but forces tolerance and multiculturalism on the students with an iron fist, went far beyond meddling in the school drama group's production. They attempted to remove the word Jew from the play. Imagine, remove the word Jew from The Merchant of Venice. By my calculation, there are 79 instances of the word Jew in The Merchant of Venice. That would require 79 edits to one of the great works of English literature, deemed necessary by a group of self-appointed language police acting in the best interests of society. One example that those who would deface Shakespeare's masterpiece are fond of citing is, quote, certainly the Jew is the very devil incarnate, Act 2, Scene 2. This glib quip, despite being an observation made by many of the great thinkers in the canon of Western thought, was clearly unacceptable to the university's indoctrinated administration. The knee-jerk reaction was nothing more than a reflex lacking any analysis. The offensive words would be removed and all would be well with the world. Yet the obvious question remained, is this a racist play or a play about racism? Sadly, it never occurred to them to ask this. They simply assumed that Shakespeare wrote this play with the intention of being politically incorrect in the 21st century. Therefore, they settled on the idea that Jew was a racist word only by non-Jews, and they decided to replace every occurrence of it in Shakespeare's play with simply Shylock. Then they decided that since it's well known that Shylock was the Jewish character's actual name, Shylock wasn't working out either, and that the character should have no name at all, much like children are forced to hum the words of Christmas carols so the non-Christian 1% of the audience is not offended. The fact that Shakespeare's play is a work of fiction was never considered. It gets worse. Upon deciding that Shylock and Jew were not appropriate, and doubtlessly pleased by their own form of reasoning, it then befell the administration to question if the moneylender formerly known as Shylock should even be portrayed as the bad guy. For was it not Antonio, the white businessman in need of a loan, who was in fact the real evil bad guy in this play? Wasn't that Shakespeare's intended message? Of course. And Shylock, he's simply a misunderstood minority and doubtlessly the victim of a hate crime. Thus, our liberal geniuses determined the now nameless Shylock should not ask for a pound of flesh as forfeit for a debt unpaid. He should instead ask for a pound of coins. This naturally required yet more rewriting of Shakespeare's classic text and the complete destruction of the play as a whole. You can see where this is going. Where still a photograph of a rehearsal made it to the front page of the local newspaper. The photograph was from a scene of the play's climax where the character formerly known as Shylock threatens Antonio with a knife while demanding his pound of coins. This too was deemed far too politically incorrect. To remedy this, the newspaper digitally manipulated the photograph so that Antonio was seen to be threatening Shylock with a knife. That's right, Antonio rather than Shylock. threatening Shylock with a knife, thus solidifying the perspective that Shylock was indeed the play's tragic victim, and the man who borrowed money was surely a nefarious villain. And who needs a theater audience when a newspaper can reach far more people with the message? You simply can't make this up. Eventually, the play was staged in front of audiences consisting mostly of high school students, though not quite as butchered as the politically correct police would have it. It was still brutally far from a full, honest treatment of Shakespeare's masterwork. Thus, given that high school students are highly unlikely to read Shakespeare on their own, the youthful audience walked away from The Merchant of Venice with little or no idea what Shakespeare actually intended. In fact, they walked away with the opposite of what Shakespeare intended, the revised message being that whites are evil and minorities are inevitably the persecuted. Shakespeare is doubtlessly the greatest playwright in English history. His tales are every bit as meaningful today as ever. The history plays depicting power struggles among would-be rulers, the eternal lessons of the tragedies, the stunning portraits of universal human characteristics seen in the romances and comedies, are all infinitely more profound than anything being produced by Hollywood or television networks. Yet Shakespeare, in fact, is currently in a period of complete demise. Since his own age, in no other period of time, has his work enjoyed less presence, popularity, or acclaim. Never before have his plays been so twisted to suit the goals of people who wish to misrepresent his intentions to suit their own agendas. Never before has Shylock been winning. Excellent post by Ulysses. And those are his words, not mine, but they're just fantastic, fantastic words and very well written. And you know, in a way, that what you say there symbolizes exactly what's happened in the current age. See, the Jewish extremists who now dominate the Hollywood media, who dominate the academia of media today, an academia of publishing and history, who dominate the really the political scene, have perverted history in a way. Just as you say that Merchant of Venice has been changed, where Antonio is now the bad guy, the knife has been taken from Shylock's hand and put into Antonio's hand, so it's true that the whole relations between Jews and Gentiles has been completely subverted and turned around. Let me give you an example. There is a lot of material, a lot of literature available about anti-Semitism. I remember when I was first investigating the Jewish question, when I was in the university at Louisiana State, I went down into the library, one of the better libraries, better university libraries in the United States, and there were literally dozens and dozens and dozens of books on so-called anti-Semitism, to explain anti-Semitism, to condemn anti-Semitism, to show the origins of anti-Semitism, etc., etc., etc. The first thing I noticed when looking at those books is that almost all the books were written by individuals who I researched and I found were Jewish extremists themselves, who supported, for instance, the extremist state of Israel, a state that doesn't allow immigration of non-Jews to the country, a state that doesn't allow marriage between Jews and non-Jews, a state that has complete and total segregation of Jews from non-Jews in apartment buildings and in settlements, in schools. It's just amazing. I mean, so these people, and who also preach that Jews are superior, are a master race, that they are the most gifted biological, mental, spiritual. In fact, there's a recent article in the New Yorker, which you can find in major Jewish publications, a recent article in the New Yorker talking about how Jews are just simply born smarter than Gentiles. Now, that's okay. You can write that. But interestingly enough, so here's these stories about Jewish supremacism, and the articles about anti-Semitism are written by Jewish supremacists. And basically the theme of almost all these books the theme is that Gentiles were very repressive and evil against Jews, intolerant of Jews, and that Jews were simply innocent lambs who were very good people, tolerant, kind, productive, etc., etc., law-abiding people, and Gentiles persecuted them unjustly. And that's the origins of anti-Semitism. They explain anti-Semitism as economic jealousy. They explain anti-Semitism as Christian animus against Jews for the supposed crucifixion of Christ. They explain anti-Semitism as simply being some sort of evil gene or something inside of Europeans. And by the way, there are many different books today about anti-Semitism and that concerned with the subject that suggests that there's something evil in Germans or something evil, in fact, in Europeans that lends itself to anti-Semitism. Even the book by the man who wrote Hitler's Willing Executioners, himself a Jewish supremacist, he suggested that there's something inside of Germans that literally makes them kill and suppress Jews, that there's some sort of evil force within them. So, I mean, again, everything's turned around. Well, here's the facts of the matter, ladies and gentlemen. The Christians were very tolerant, by the way, toward Jews. They let these Jews who were not Christians into their own countries. And they believed that even though they certainly wanted this Christian faith in their own societies, they wanted the Jews to convert. And they accepted. They had no racial animus against the Jews. They accepted any Jew who did convert to Christianity as a full brother Christian. In fact, many Jews rose in the Catholic Church. In fact, many Jews, in fact, were some of the early Christian leaders in Europe. That's a fact. And later on, all through time, including today, even in the Catholic Church, one of the highest cardinals in the Catholic Church is, in fact, the Jewish individual in France. I'm not sure he's a sincere Catholic, frankly, but there's been many cases such as this, and this was allowed. On the opposite hand, Judaism was strictly based on faith. They never tried to convert Christians, and if a Christian did convert to Judaism, they and their descendants were never allowed to become the leaders of Judaism, weren't even allowed in that priest class, the Kohanim, as I talked about earlier. This was very strict. And if you take a look at the Jewish books, like the Talmud, basically preaches that Gentiles are supernal refuse, that Gentiles are soulless creatures, that Gentiles are much like animals, that you can't drink after a Gentile. You can't even share the same bottle of wine, even if your lips don't touch the same glass or bottle. We can go on and on, that it's okay that if a Gentile is killed, that's okay, but a Jew can't be killed. The striking a Jew is like striking God. Now, there was nothing that corresponds like this in the Christian faith. And Christians did accept Jews who converted, but the anti-Gentile animus, and so what I'm trying to say is that a lot of the anti-Semitism came from the fact people like Martin Luther, who was able to read Hebrew and investigate the Talmud, and he was Martin Luther was a very, very pro-Semitic, pro-Jewish individual at one point in his life. That's the right term. Again, anti-Semitism isn't a good term because that would make one who was opposed to Jewish extremists to be against all the people of the Arab world. And that's certainly not my purpose or my definition. But Luther read the Talmud and he investigated the Talmud and he found that the Talmud was full of extremely anti-Christian, anti-Gentile remarks, vicious remarks, and he reacted to it himself. So, again, anti-Semitism is always portrayed as a Gentile, an evil action of Gentiles against Jews, when the truth is that anti-Semitism or opposition to Jews basically came as a result of some of the actions of Jews concerning Gentiles. When Gentiles discovered the Jewish writings, when Gentiles were concerned about some of the corruption, the financial corruption, the usury, for instance. In fact, it should be called loan sharking, which is illegal in most states in the United States and many countries. Because, in fact, there's nothing that can be stronger than the biting of a loan shark. I mean, you can destroy families and homes, and the Jewish supremacists were very effective at that, the Jewish extremists. Not all Jews, obviously, and not all Jews have acted evilly in our society. But it's important on any issue and any question of the day that you read both sides and you are able to understand all points of view from every point of view. If you can't get both sides, then there's no way you can ever learn. So just as in Canada, where this high school play, where the name Jew was taken out and where the knife was taken from Shylock's hand and put electronically or digitally into the hand of Antonio, where history was totally changed. So that's exactly what they've done today. There's been a reaction to Jewish supremacism, and they basically now, because they control the media, they've made it out that Europeans were all the evil ones and that the Jews are always innocent. And I beg to question. I'm not saying that the Europeans were always innocent, and I'm not saying Jews were always guilty, but I do believe that there's at least as much argument that Jews brought on anti-Semitism by their actions. And by the way, a number of Jewish writers have said that themselves, that Jewish actions brought on negative Gentile reactions. This is from Son of Thunder. He says, glad to see you're back. Watch your six over there. Keep up the good work, and thanks for reading the article on Jewish Santa that got beat up. You can bet that if he were actually a Christian, we would hear about it. I noticed that here it is 9 days after the event, and we hear about it from a poor translation of Hebrew on a Jewish web news site. Had it been a group of Christians beating a guy with a yarmulke, it would have been world news, and perpetrators would be known by everyone. I look forward to your new book. You're awakening many people, preparing them for the message. I truly believe that we're seeing a turning of the tide in our struggle for our race. The revealing of the terrors spoken of by Christ in Matthew 13 is happening before our eyes. These are truly exciting times. Thanks, Bill. And let me tell you something. I think your point is very well taken. And take a look at it. Imagine for a moment if a Santa Claus, or as to say some sort of Jewish figure, was beaten by Gentiles, skinheads or whatever, screaming dead Jews or die Jews. I mean, that would have been a hate crime par excellence, and that would have been a worldwide event, and that's exactly what's happening. Well, I don't know why I'm breaking. He also says that I'm breaking up and rebuffering. I hope that we'll get that corrected. Let me know if anybody else is having that problem. I don't know. Are you on a, Bill, are you on a dial-up or are you on a high speed? It's important for us to let us know. Here's one from, he said it's happening for him too. And here's one, he says it's for me too. It's extremely annoying. I can't go on listening because of the breakup. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to archive it for download in just a moment because I've got a perfect copy here. So it will be available. That's how we're going to do it. In fact, that's enough for right today. We're back. Thank goodness. It's good to be back with you, and I'll be very happy to share my thoughts with you again tomorrow. Thanks a lot for everybody sticking with us, and sorry for the tremendous delay on our website. And I certainly am suspicious that there were foul forces at work trying to prevent this program from going around the world and preventing the important news on my website. And you'll be seeing a lot of my updates very soon on the DavidDuke.com. website. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks again for being with me, and I will certainly be with you very soon. I will post a number of new articles coming up tomorrow, and until then, I just have to tell you, God bless and take care. Bye-bye now.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.